This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Alina Scheim. She's Executive Director of Impact Personal Safety. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it's the 15th anniversary of the organization, and we thought we would help you celebrate, see where you're at. What's Impact about? How did it start?
Absolutely. So we started 15 years ago as a project that got started at the Rape Crisis Center, which is now known as SALAS. It was there was a volunteer, Tanya Doris, who was working on the crisis line for them at the time, and she had taken an impact self-defense class while she was in California, which she later used when someone attacked her and successfully got out of that situation in a way that she was happy with and not traumatized by. And so she asked, you know, once she realized what a big problem violence was in New Mexico, and especially violence against women, she asked, would you like this to be here? And the first people that did the class were clients, staff, and volunteers of SALAS. And their response was so great, they said, we need to have this here in New Mexico. How can we make that happen?
And so the class and the classes are, first of all, about self-defense, which isn't necessarily all a physical process. It's very much of a how you carry yourself and how you respond verbally and body language-wise and stuff in a situation.
Yeah, and I appreciate you pointing that out. We did get started as a self-defense organization and what's called an empowerment-based self-defense program, which it distinguishes itself, just as you say, from specifically doing only physical skills to acknowledging that if most violence is by people we know, we need so many other skills to get out of those situations or to navigate those situations. We need verbal strategies and communication skills. We need to boost our confidence and feelings of empowerment. And body language is really where it all starts of, you know, having that congruent messaging, as well as, you know, I think the directions that we've moved into more recently. In 2007, we expanded from being a self-defense only organization to doing all forms of violence prevention. And, you know, the biggest piece sometimes is just going against a culture that promotes violence in so many ways and that blames victims for what happens to them. So that's a huge part of what we do in our self-defense classes, as well as our other classes that we do in schools.
How did you yourself get involved?
I was working at Esperanza, the domestic violence shelter here in town, and I had started looking for a self-defense class that would address what my concerns were as a young person. Probably when I was about 15 or 16, I started taking self-defense and trying out martial arts classes, and I like to joke that I wasn't continuing to take them because I was having a good time. I was taking them because that concern was still there for me. It was really an impediment in my life, and I really realized that. And so when I moved here, I took the next self-defense class, and it so happened that it addressed what I needed. And it was really, it shifted so many things in my life and really made my life bigger instead of smaller, which is...
What do you mean? Like, what happened?
You know, I think so much of it is, you know, I think most of us walk around with these what-if questions of, like, I'd love to go on that hike, but what if I ran into a guy on the trail that had bad intentions? I really need to go to the grocery store. I really want to go to that concert, but I don't have someone to go with me. Maybe I'll go tomorrow to the grocery store. Things like that, which I think are very subtle. You know, we just rearrange our lives without realizing it. But also, by the time I was working at Esperanza, I was clear that I knew how to not date someone who would be abusive to me anymore, but I really didn't know how to date in a healthy way. So there were these concrete things around sexual assault and around dating that I just felt stumped about. And no amount of counseling, and I think this is true for many of our students, no amount of counseling could really address this kind of physical experience and memories that I had that just made it really challenging to have healthy relationships and go through life in a healthy way.
I think it's we're living in an interesting time because I think a lot of people are realizing that so much of your mental state is located in the whole body, not just in your head.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are changing their mind through changing what they eat, for example, mm-hmm. and changing their outlook on things like what you're talking about, dating, by going through the physical motions mm-hmm. as opposed to sitting on a couch and having right. a conversation about it.
Right. I think that's such a beautiful way of expressing that. And I think, you know, we talk about our classes as being embodied experiences. So embodying what it is we want to change can just be, one, more direct, and two, sneakier. One thing I really love about impact is that, you know, we don't have to talk directly about the problems, which for folks who don't remember what happened to them, or maybe that's just too hard, it can be a really profound way of just interacting with it in a way that, you know, you don't put up your mental defenses as much.
I imagine that in the classes, there's not only are people learning skills, but they're probably going through all kinds of personal stuff and reliving mm-hmm. stuff, and the instructors have to be instructed in how to handle that's mm-hmm. those things when they come up.
Our instructors are incredibly heavily trained, and I say for myself as well, going through the instructor training, it was impossible not to come out as a different person. And I think that's, you know, something I don't say lightly, of saying, you know, we get trained in psychology, we get trained in educational practices, we get trained in acting skills, we get trained in, you know, all of social justice, all of these things that just, you know, it's not like any other profession where you can go to college and be like, I was trained as a counselor, I'm going to get hired as a therapist for this agency now. No one's really trained in the complexity of what it is. Everyone comes with a different skill set. I came with both personal and professional experience with domestic violence, for instance. But I had so many other things to learn, public speaking. So it is true, we interact with students in a very vulnerable space, and we don't take that lightly. And, you know, we try to be really responsible with the fact that we do adrenaline-based training, and we know that anything you learn with adrenaline in your body can stay with you for life, just like riding a bike or learning how to swim. And the weird thing about that is that even the words that people say to you when you're adrenalized go in deeper. So we've heard stories of people after they defended themselves in real lives, hearing their instructor coaching them in their heads, or even just having a hard conversation with a boss or a coworker, that they heard us coaching them in their heads. And so for us, that's a lot of responsibility. If I'm going to hang out in somebody's brain like that, I want to be really conscious of how I'm supporting them.
Adrenaline-based training means what? You put people into a state of fear while they're being trained?
I would say it seems like a nuance to say it just in a different order, but I would say that fear and adrenaline is a natural response to simulated assault scenarios or even simulated hard conversations. So thinking of asking for that raise that you really deserve, that all of your coworkers got raises and for some reason you didn't. That is an adrenalizing situation. So is simulating an experience where someone might be threatening you in a physical way or even starting to assault you. So that is a natural consequence. It is not that we set out to scare people. So I think that that's a critical distinction, very subtle and semantic, but also real.
We're talking to Alina Scheim of Impact Personal Safety. Now, you are doing a lot of programs right now in addition to the self-defense work and those classes that people can still take, and they have them for women, for kids, for teenagers, for adults, mixed classes, the whole thing. You are also doing anti-bullying work.
Mm-hmm. So the reality nowadays, after 2007, we expanded so much into other forms of violence prevention that 90% of what we do is in the schools or other partnerships at no cost and doesn't actually do self-defense per se at all. So the program that we have that's really popular right now is called Walk the Talk. It's our anti-bias and anti-bullying program. And that is a terrific program that guides people in learning empathy and really feeling that in a personal, again, embodied way. That's one of the things that we really value. We also value skill building, so not just knowing intellectually what I would like to do when I see moments of injustice or someone being treated badly, but actually practicing speaking up for myself and then speaking up for others. One thing that we really hold is that we have to know how to advocate for ourselves before we can go, wow, that situation over there looks really awful. I'm going to go do something about it.
So you do kind of like role playing or simulation?
We do. So we build up to it. Obviously, it's not the first thing that we do. We want to build trust and language and empathy and that motivation to do something about it, which we work with middle schoolers at this for this class. And what I like to say is middle schoolers are just ready, right? They know. They're just born activists. They know when something doesn't feel okay. They don't always know the right way to articulate it or to communicate it to others to get their support. But so what we're doing is rather than trying to convince them that something is wrong, they know it's wrong. We just help them find the language to describe it and the language to speak up about it.
So what are some examples of what you teach to middle schoolers? Like, walk us through, like, I'm a middle schooler and trying to deal with something that I perceive as wrong, but I don't have the words to say it.
Mm-hmm. So I think one thing that we do, the first exercise is I tell them that it's the most boring part, but we just want to get that common language. So we talk about prejudice, stereotyping, ally behavior, discrimination, all of those words, and then we go through different identities, racism, sexism, homophobia, etc. And then we go through history a little bit and talk about, so what was an example of discrimination? Oh, the civil rights was an example of that paired with racism. Okay. So what was an example of ally behavior? And one thing that I think is really valuable for students to learn is who probably had the idea first that slavery was wrong? Was it, you know, and they always come up with, like, the president. Like, well, do you think slave owners were the first people that thought it was wrong? Like, actually, probably it was slaves. It was probably black people that thought it was wrong first. However, could they shift things on their own? And typically, when we look through all the moments in history that we can look at, typically people need allies. They need people that are in more positions of privilege or power to be able to help shift things. And so we talk about that with present day events. And what really grounds all of this is then in the next activity, we do an exercise in which we put labels on their back. And we put labels such as, like, 80-year-old woman speaks with a quote-unquote foreign accent. All of these different things, as well as, you know, Harvard graduate, classically very attractive. And they get to experience, they don't know what their labels are, and through role plays they get to experience what it feels like to be treated different ways based on those labels. And that can be extremely profound, and it can help them, you know, and of course afterwards we debrief it and we talk about, when have you ever felt like you were being treated like a label? And it helps them suddenly be able to describe what it is that they have experienced that they thought was messed up, or like they got into a fight over and then got kicked out of school, and, you know, a lot of consequences that they've had for not being able to actually articulate what was so troubling about that situation and what they wanted to be different.
I would think that part of that exercise is not only feeling what it's like to be treated with, you know, a prejudicial attitude of one kind or another, mm-hmm. but also to treat somebody else with that, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. when you, you know, you put a label on somebody, you as the role player mm-hmm. have to feel that inside of yourself.
And we never have them play the role of aggressors.
Oh, okay.
So I will always embody that. And at Impact, if you've seen our classes, we oftentimes use sunglasses to differentiate our roles so they don't think I'm the one saying these horrible things to them or treating them badly. But what does happen in the class is that we definitely build empathy for, you know, what we talk about as microaggressions. And I talk about, you know, one example I use a lot is I have a colleague who lives in another city, who's another director of Impact and elsewhere, and she is significantly older than me. She's retired, technically, even though she still does the work. And she is amazing with social media. She's amazing with technology. That would be true regardless, but especially because she's older, it's surprising to a lot of people. And I've noticed that I've given her positive feedback around that, and I've heard other people doing it to the extent that I was like, oh, I don't think this actually feels good to her. I think this feels like a, wow, you're so amazing about this because you're old.
Yeah, for an old person, you're really good at social media, yeah.
And so that's an example I use in all of my classes and say, look, like, we can say things with the best intentions, and sometimes they're informed by this stuff that it's inevitable that we absorb, right? Ageism is something that is true in our society. And so I think those moments where, you know, rather than me saying, oh, I'm perfect, I do everything perfectly, for them to reflect and go, oh, yeah, I get how, you know, like, we want to help, you know, maybe an older person with a walker cross the road if they want help. But if they do not want help and everyone is just forcing themselves on that person, that's not actually useful. That's not a way of showing up and being an ally. That's destructive for that person.
You do a program which is called Everyday Interventions.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
So it is that piece about how do we support other people? So this is a real theme of not only how do we advocate for ourselves, but regardless of whether we're, you know, the rates of domestic violence and sexual assault, particularly in our state, is incredibly high. And meanwhile, what we can guarantee is that almost everyone is going to be in a role where they're supporting someone who's going through this, or where we could support someone. And so in that exercise, we explore what it is. We do this in a lot of health classes now, with ninth graders especially. And in that class, we explore what are ways that we might respond, that people might respond to someone going through, in this case, a relationship with someone who's abusive. And we do a lot of exercises where we show reactions, again, through role plays. That's a heavy part of our program, of someone saying, you know, oh, I thought he was awful from the beginning. I can't believe you're still with him. You should just dump him already. I'll be here for you when you're ready to do that. And, right, we can see the intention of support there, but we can also see the frustration and the blaming of the person experiencing this and the conditional, I will be here for you, but only once you're ready to be at this stage. And so one of the things, again, you know, I we do at Impact with still clear boundaries, I reflect on, you know, my experience leaving someone who was abusive to me. And I had so many people with such good intentions that, you know, there were these little nuggets of bad stuff in what they were saying that made it difficult for them to be as supportive as I think they really wanted to be.
So what's the right thing to do in that situation?
Mm-hmm.
Your best friend is with somebody who really needs dumping badly.
Or therapy, or right. So one of the things that I think is really important is that we don't want to have the solutions for them. And I think that's really difficult. And to acknowledge, you know, one piece that we talk about is processing with someone that is not your friend or even their best friend, but, you know, being able to say to someone that they don't even know, to say, you know, my friend is going through this, keeping confidentiality, but saying, like, I just need support in order to be able to talk with this person and not get my own reactions and my own feelings all over them.
But what do you say to your friend?
So some of the language, so again, we role play the what we call better reactions. So some of the things are, one of the reactions is, God, I'm so sorry you're going through that. No one deserves to be treated that way. It must be so confusing for you to have someone that you love hurt you. How can I help? And right, the components that we break down then, what are useful about those phrases are leaving the decision and the control in the person experiencing abuse and violation, so letting it be up to them, which, again, we want to solve it, we're uncomfortable with it, we just want it to be over. But acknowledging that most violence happens by people that someone is really attached to and has feelings for. And so it's not as cut and dry of that. And control is fundamentally part of abuse and assault. And so giving them back control, this is the phrase that we always want, is that how do we empower people in bad situations experiencing abuse.
That's interesting. So in a way, if somebody's in an abusive relationship, the controlling person wants to control them, and their best friend also wants to control them by dragging them out of the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
And you can see it's such a good intention, and unfortunately can play out in not great ways for that person that we're actually trying to support and really love.
Now, you are also doing programs in the schools around sex education, reproductive health, things like that.
So we are in a partnership for the Reproductive Health Week. In the 7th and 8th grade, we do curriculum in the 8th grade. So thankfully, Planned Parenthood and nurses and Solace do a lot of the curriculum in partnership with us. And what we talk about is early forms of violence prevention, what we call safety myths, all the things that we've been told about how to stay safe that actually are really limiting and don't actually make us safer. Like not going out late at night, like not carrying, like deciding to carry keys between our fingers or not wear short skirts or, you know, all things that we go, wow, that's, but I actually need to leave the house late at night, but I actually want to hike by myself. All these things that, you know, if we're being clear about how that's gendered language, you know, men are not told that they shouldn't go to a gas station and fill up their gas past 7 p.m. And the reality is I need to fill up my gas after 7 p.m.
You know, it's funny because there are realities of time, place, country. I mean, there are some places where you read the guidebook and you must not go out uncovered, or you must not go out after a certain time because you're in a foreign country and there are completely different sets of rules and completely different sets of, I mean, really bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily myths. So drawing that line between where it's a myth and not a myth has something to do with how safe your town actually is.
I think that is partially true. And what I'll say is that, you know, one of the things that really informs us is that, depending on the statistics you look at, 80 to 90% of sexual assault is by someone that we know. And typically when we're talking about women, and especially young women, we're talking about sexual assault. And so when all of the advice that we're given is about stranger situations and not at all about people we know, I would say that misleads us into focusing on not trusting people we don't know, on not trusting people who are unlike us and who look different from us or have different life circumstances than us, and puts me in a situation where, you know, I'm with someone that I know through community or through who I'm dating, and suddenly just, you know, they get a little card that says, like, totally good, couldn't possibly hurt you. So I think it shifts our focus. And what I also hear oftentimes from people who have experienced violence by strangers is we still need to look to identify the behavior that someone is using. So that's the shift that Impact offers in this class, is how can we focus instead of on situations and demographics and our own behavior and what we're doing, and say, huh, that person is ignoring me saying no. That person is trying to act like we're closer than we are, when we're really not actually that close. So again, getting it out of circumstances and behaviors and just those sort of exterior things, and getting it into things that we can observe and think about. And meanwhile, as we both know about each other, I love traveling, and I know you do too. And so I think that's something that I personally really grapple with, and I think that's the truth, is that all of us really grapple with, of how much is this true? How much of is this, you know, things that things people say in the United States that I would personally label as a myth, but I have enough experience in the United States to say, I know that's a myth. Versus when I go to another country, I don't know that as readily, so I really have to investigate. And so much of it comes down to risk tolerance. You know, how much am I, in order to have a good, pleasant experience, how much am I willing to risk?
Alina Scheim is Executive Director of Impact Personal Safety, and on Friday, August 28th, there's going to be a wonderful event, which is a celebration of the 15th anniversary of Impact and a fundraiser. And tell us a little bit about this event.
Yeah, it's our 15th anniversary. We're calling it our Crystal Anniversary Celebration. Mayor Javier Gonzalez has graciously agreed to both be our honorary chair and the master of ceremonies. And we'll be having that at La Posada. And it's going to be a fantastic event with an auction as well as a gourmet dinner and music. It'll be a fantastic event. And we're so excited to get to celebrate what we've done for 15 years and also talk about moving into the future.
Impact Personal Safety is on the web at impactpersonalsafety.org. The number here in Santa Fe is 505-992-8833. Alina, thank you so much for being with us and for the wonderful work you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.